Welcome to A Lovely Wallpaper, a podcast exploring an underappreciated way of appreciating poetry by committing it to memory. To know a poem by heart means having a worry stone, a provocation, a comfort, a quick exit, always close at hand. Lose yourself in a poem, gain a world with its mastery.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that a loss is no disaster.
In this episode, we will work with the helpful voice of Kate Lebo on Robert Frost's poem, The Rose Family. Kate is a writer, an apprentice cheesemaker at Quillisaskut Farms, a baker, and a philosopher cum booster of the lesser-known, lesser-loved fruits. Among Kate's books are Pie School, Pie and Whiskey, and The Commonplace Book of Pie. I reached out to her after reading her 2021 collection of essays, The Book of Difficult Fruit, which includes plenty of recipes and plenty of pies, but is a much more prickly beast. In this book, Kate goes for fruit that is hard to get, hard to prepare, or even hard to smell. Sometimes her searching essays resolve in something wonderful to eat, like quince jelly or thimbleberry kvass or yuzu marmalade. Other times, dealing with trickier ingredients like aronia or osagi orange, she ends up with a recipe for mulch or dye, for spider repellent, or for sinus wash. So it is a funny book and an ambitious book. In the memoir, The Gastronomical Me, renowned food writer M.F.K. Fisher writes, "The first thing I remember tasting, and then wanting to taste again, is the grayish-pink fuzz my grandmother skimmed from a kettle of strawberry jam. Strawberries, like nearly a quarter of the 26 fruits Lebo examines in her ABC Darien of Fruits, plums, medlars, and cherries, for instance, are part of the botanical rose family. And the gray fuzz, which Fisher describes here, is also an important part of the cosmos of the Book of Difficult Fruit." Kate has a reverence for the processes and the byproducts of cooking. Hello, Kate. Thanks for joining me from Spokane.
Hi, Abby. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to just go ahead and start with this one great moment when you're discussing wine grapes and talking about your choice to write about the North American Norton grape, which is apparently the state grape of Missouri, over more like known and respected standby varietals. And you say that you are, quote, "not one to enjoy shouting in a crowded room." I think it says a lot about the project of your whole book. Could you tell me a little more about what drew you to writing about fruits which don't wear their deliciousness on their sleeve?
You know, it started with a bite of quince that I took from a bag of quince that a friend brought to me. And the way that I felt betrayed and tricked by this incredibly beautiful and beautiful smelling fruit into eating something that was actually so astringent and sour that it kind of felt like it was sucking all the moisture out of my mouth. And that was a moment for me where I realized like I had come to expect fruit and much of my food to be palatable and to be easy. And I'm a writer, so of course I'm immediately thinking about how those expectations extend to writing. And at the time, I was getting close to, probably about a year out from starting to work on my trilogy of pie books, Pie School in particular, which is a cookbook that was re-released last year. And one of my concerns at that time, and it remains a concern, but not in the same way that it did, you know, this was about 10 years ago, a bit more than that, was the ways that by writing about the sweet subject of pie, I was tapping into an excitement and enthusiasm and something deeper that I couldn't quite name that this food conjured for people. But I was also tapping into an expectation of sweetness and of a certain kind of palatability that freaked me out when it came to being a writer, because I did not want to be stuck with that subject or with the persona that the subject implied. And a cookbook, which is what I was writing at the time, didn't turn out to be the best place to investigate all this, because I think that, I mean, for me, the contract that a cookbook makes with the reader is it's going to teach you how to make the thing that it has promised to teach you how to make. It's not necessarily, maybe it's going to serve you a bunch of other ideas on the side, but the main thing that I wanted to accomplish and that I felt like duty bound to accomplish was just teach someone how to make a great pie, which is hard enough. So as I was at writing pie school, I really started kind of identifying and gathering all these experiences and ways of cooking and baking and fruits that just didn't fit in a regular pie cookbook. And those, among other things, eventually became the Book of Difficult Fruit and my interest and obsession with fruit that doesn't reveal itself or give itself as easily as, you know, an apple or a banana or whatever we're used to just picking up from the grocery store and shoving in our faces.
I mean, that's so funny. You mentioned the contract with the reader. The other contract is, which I'm going to teach you, but also this is going to be delicious. This is going to be great. And in this book, you play a lot more with recipes that you can't really vouch for. You're like, it was an interesting journey, but don't know if I would do that again.
Right. No, and this book provided an opportunity to do that. You know, and in addition to pie school, I was able to push that a little bit. I've got a chapter of difficult fruit pies, of pies that didn't fit into this book. So it's kind of fun that pie school gave birth to Book of Difficult Fruit, but then there was stuff left over from Book of Difficult Fruit that now fits into pie school. But those recipes, like I have a recipe for, it's a pear and elderberry pie, and it is just like this close to not being worth it to make. Speaking as someone who just like, I just don't like the way elderberries taste. So it became this fun challenge to figure out how do I use this fruit that I have in my own backyard, kind of sticking to these values that I've developed over the course of writing these books over 10 years of using what's in my backyard to make something good. But I think the question remains whether someone would ever make that, you know, and that's a cookbook question. In a book of essays, oh man, like you get to fail in an essay. You get to try and you get to fail, right? That's kept as part of the root of that word. We hear that repeated over and over, almost to the point of cliche when we talk about essays. But I think it's so true and offered such a opportunity for the food writer part of me in that because I was writing essays, not a cookbook, I could write recipes that might even be dangerous. You know, like I've got a recipe that basically makes poison if your
third item on the contract won't kill you.
And there's lots of warnings all over, you know, the book when I have things like that. But I mean, it's an old school cherry stone extract that I first heard about from a food scientist who would not go on the record and talk about it, you know, but, you know, off the record was telling me about ways that her grandmother would make this. So I don't know. I'm just
well, thank you for your openness to liability, because I loved to hear about it's persipan is what it's called.
Yeah, persipan.
As a huge fan of marzipan. And what is the plumstone one? There's a
that one. So I suggested making persipan from plumstones.
Okay.
Usually it's made from apricot.
Oh, apricot stones. Okay. I guess that's what I find in like German cookies. That's sometimes an apricot stone one, but the cherry one is the one to look out for, right?
For all of them.
All of them have to get our listeners up to speed. There's cyanide in there. Cyanide in the kernel of these fruits.
Oh, but it's so interesting that so within any, you know, cherry pit, apricot pit, plum pit, peach pit, any of these stone fruits, there is a kernel that when you eat it has this lovely almond flavor. But that almond flavor, what you're tasting is almonds also splitting into a little bit of cyanide. Now, there's ways that we ingest or interact with cyanide all the time that we're used to. Like if you smoke cigarettes, for example, that doesn't kill us or eventually kills us in the case of cigarettes, but usually it's not the cyanide, it's other stuff. So it just becomes a question of, I mean, there's ways that our food contains substances that can hurt us all the time, but we usually don't consume them in amounts and at frequencies that would hurt us at all and your body can handle, you know? So I love that pairing of a delicious flavor with a poison that you have to watch out for.
I mean, speaking of let food be your medicine and your medicine be your food, one thing that comes up again and again in your book is the medieval doctrine of signatures. Kate, would you mind reading me a passage from your book on the doctrine of signatures?
Got it. An alternative guide to food as medicine, one that lingers in our collective imagination, despite a slew of evidence that contradicts its advice, is the doctrine of signatures. This ancient method of identifying the medicinal properties of the vegetable kingdom observes a plant's shape, color, odor, or habitat, and relates these characteristics to human body parts and conditions we imagine those plants resemble. So lungwort's mottled leaves look like sick lungs, which signals that it aids respiratory diseases. Eyebright's white lash flowers indicate that the plant will help sight. Stinging nettles echo the sting of allergy, so we use them to reduce our histamine response. Eat carrots to see in the dark. Eat bread crusts to make hair curl. In Christian cultures, God formed these signatures to help people identify how to heal themselves. But the doctrine of signatures appears with or without that ideology and with or without that name all over the world throughout human history, from ancient Rome to English herbalists of the Middle Ages, from Renaissance physicians to modern-day Israeli folk medicine, from Native American medicinal traditions to ancient and modern Chinese medicine. This relation between plant and human parts is underpinned by a shared understanding between healer and patient, that the human body ends not at our skins, but extends into nature, that what is in nature is also in us. It is not so much a list of prescriptions as a way of seeing and making sense of how a world that harms our bodies can also heal them.
It's such a cool approach to a plant life, to uses for plants. And I had to ask about it. I had to ask you to read that passage, and I wanted to discuss it because I'm drawn to it. It's a poetic device extended out to medicine. It's metonymy used towards scientific ends. A little bit later in that passage, I think you even call it a visual rhyme, which it is.
And I think that's one of the reasons it continues to make sense to us, even though it is magical. It is not science-based. Many of these remedies don't work. What I was interested in as I was writing this book, and particularly that passage in the chapter Aronia that it's in, is just trying to understand why I thought food was medicine. I mean, that's a truism that's passed down. That's a way of relating to food that my mother was trying to teach me and did successfully teach me. But that doesn't mean that I understood how it was at work in my life. And I wanted to, I guess I found the relationship between medicine and poison very confusing and very exciting. In a literary way, but also just in a daily, how do I take care of myself kind of way.
Right, right. This doctrine of signatures, I mean, it's interesting insofar too, is it just, it's a different way of relating than what we're used to nowadays. It's this kind of observation-based sensibility. And it almost helps to answer the question of how people experimented with things, you know, over the course of human history. Like, how did they decide that we could use this for this? You know, it seems like a gateway into that almost, like something that's a little bit more comprehensible than, you know, than total randomness. So I love Frost the Rose Family, and I invited you on here to read that poem later in the episode. Partially because I just thought about it every time I came upon another member of the Rosaceae as I was reading the book. It's a poem that I used to teach sometimes when I was teaching high school. But I also was just curious because the rose does have its own fruit of sorts, the rose hip. And last summer I tried to dry some, but they all blew away before I could make my tea out of them, which was very difficult of them, admittedly. But I wonder, have you ever done anything with rose hips before?
Not yet. I just planted a woods rose alongside my house as part of erosion control and trying to get some more native plants around the house. But it hasn't bloomed yet. So I'm hoping maybe this year.
Oh, well, beautiful. Good luck on that. You weren't tempted to use blackberries as erosion controls? Kate has a chapter about blackberries and the way they really go. Absolutely, they become totally unruly and take over land. Good as erosion control, bad as...
I mean, good as erosion control to trying to find something nice to say about them.
That is where the mulch...
You have to live with them, so right. They're not a bad thing to try to do.
That is where the mulch recipe comes from, the blackberries. Kate writes about the blackberries, and you know there are a million ways to make blackberries taste nice. But for one of her recipes... She talked about the need to pull them up when these non-native blackberries. Tell me again the species that you write about.
Himalaya blackberries.
Himalaya blackberries, which are so invasive, completely take over. When farmers have to remove them, the best thing to do is chop them into mulch, right?
Well, that's one thing too. I mean, that was another example of just trying I wanted to imagine a recipe that was not edible for blackberries and that would engage with that part of their difficulty, the need to get rid of them and find something useful once you got rid of them. And my friend Will Unger, who is part of a berry farming family, he gave me that idea of like, well, we could use them as mulch. Try it this way.
More is involved in mulch than people give it credit for. You know, there's a lot to it. Mulch and compost really are recipes in and of themselves. So as far as the Rose family goes, obviously I was drawn to it because of all of these different kind of unexpected members, things that don't flower like the roses that you think of when you imagine roses. But I also, when I suggested this poem to you, I realized after I did, I felt a little self-conscious about asking you to read a love poem just off the bat. But then I realized that the Book of Difficult Fruit is a bit of a love story too, actually. The essays come together beautifully in all kinds of different through stories about your life. In one of these through stories, the pieces track through a very kind of difficult, volatile relationship to a quieter, stabler new love. Had you intended, when you were writing this book, had you intended for the essays to have these through stories, or how did you end up with this structure?
You know, I think the idea for the book started with stories that felt unrelated, like this conflict that I had with a previous partner where I was a huge pie maker and he discovered he had celiac disease. And we, of course, had other issues, but that became just such a way to have the conflict that we really needed to have so that we could break apart and get into better situations with other people. But yeah, it, at that point, felt kind of faded when it was happening. And what am I trying to say? Not faded. I'll take that back. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there were several moments that inspired the book at the beginning that made me feel like, oh, maybe if I write these stories, I'll be able to see how they are related. And then if I can see how they are related, I'll be able to see what the shape of the book might be. You know, and that was this, you know, relationship that I had with someone who had celiac disease when I was a pie maker, and what I loved to make, if I was not careful, would make him sick. One of them was that bite of quince that I was talking about earlier, and trying to figure out how to express the shock, betrayal, delight of that as a story in some way, and figure out why that was important. And another was this relationship between the delicious flavor in cyanide in stone fruits, which is in cherry. And another was huckleberry, which I became interested in because I knew that it was sacred to the indigenous tribes of the area where I live. But I also know that it's an incredibly important food way to everyone else. And there's a lot of conflict, heartache, and just politics that can be bound up within that relationship. And I wonder, can this fruit help me understand how we relate to each other right now within my own community? So those were four kind of guiding stories for me to get started. But as I wrote, I think what became necessary was using that Abecedarian form, the A to Z, and finding something new each time. As I was writing and researching each different one, the structure of the book emerged by me paying attention to repetitions, rhymes, metaphor, and I mean that just in like idea rhymes, image rhymes, just things coming up again and developing in some surprising way. I knew that I needed to kind of get the story of that partnership, you know, into a satisfying conclusion. I needed to get the broken relationship with my aunt that's included in the story too, also to a satisfying place. But I think other than that, I didn't have an idea of a plot necessarily. It was really more trying to understand if you put A, B, C, D, E, and so on together, how do they relate? And how do those relationships kind of pile up and ring against each other and then end up giving you the feeling of a finished book and a movement toward understanding?
I do, because you feel the development of ideas around all of these difficult fruit, and you feel the passage of time too. You feel the passage of time in the project. So it's hard to imagine that you're negotiating the alphabet along with these essays that do feel well-ordered together. And then what do you do for the really difficult letters? You have, I know you have yuzu. What did you have? Oh, xylitol is what you did for X.
Yeah. And at some point, what I was hoping I could get away with is, I mean, it becomes clear, hopefully, as you read, that fruit as a category can be somewhat arbitrary. We call rhubarb fruit. It's not a fruit. It's a vegetable, if it's anything. We call tomato vegetable. It's a fruit. We call, you know, oysters fruit of the sea. So this is a useful term in that we generally have an idea of what a fruit is, but it's also really baggy and includes things that botanically are not fruit. So of course, the writer in me wants to make sure that I get to use fruit as a metaphor as much as possible. And one of the ways I did that was by stretching the idea of fruit even further by having things that were definitely not fruit. Well, as a couple of the chapter headings, xylitol is one, lump is another, sugar cane.
And for lump, you're talking about tumor in that case, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about other kinds of growths.
Yeah. And there are some things that don't sound like they would be fruits, but are, like vanilla and wheat berries, right? Didn't hear you.
That's my favorite, is when I hear someone be like, that's not a fruit. What is she talking about? You know, and in that case, I'm that is fruit. Believe me. But I understand why a reader might get a little confused or has to with me.
And then it goes right back to Robert Frost and his, a plum is a rose and a pear is a rose, you know.
If a plum's a rose and a pear is a rose, what is a rose?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's so interesting, the tangled, you know, webs of all these genuses and species. I wonder, do you have any, like, favorite chapters? Are there any places where you felt like you were championing something that you had, like, a special allegiance to? Or is that hard to pick?
Oh, you mean to the fruit?
Mm-hmm.
Writing the durian chapter was such a journey for me. It happened over the course of a fairly long period of time, and that I did a lot of different drafts, but then also discovered as I was writing that this fruit that I did not like and could not bring myself to like, through attempting to make sure that I wasn't exaggerating anything about how I didn't like it, because I felt like that would be a disservice to the fruit. And it often is met with this exaggerated disgust. In an attempt to kind of fact check myself, I kind of developed a taste for it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not, I'm not, you know, like picking durian amongst all the fruits as my favorite fruit, but certainly compared to someone who has not eaten that much durian and also doesn't like it, I don't mind it. So that was wonderful to be so changed over time and acquaintanceship with this fruit. I salute durian for changing me. And I think another thing that I ended up getting even more excited about, let's see, what would it be? You know, it's so funny. I just love medlars. I love the idea of the medlar, which is this fruit that isn't cultivated very much. It's also in the rose family. It looks like a really exaggerated rose hip. You can really only get access to them from other people's landscapings, which is a fun way to make friends or get yourself in trouble, depending. And I love the idea of the medlar because it is ripe once it's rotten, which is a process called bledding. So many...
Bledding?
Yeah, so many metaphoric possibilities with that one. And it's also real. That's a real thing about it. But really, it doesn't taste that good. It was another one that, as my love for it grew, my love for its flavor stayed about the same.
So I have a durian success story with the medlar. It's funny. I mean, it's romanticized in my head because I've only heard the word in Shakespeare, I think. Like you only hear it, you know, from old texts, but it wasn't good. I think you tried to rot it a few different ways too, right? And you found subtle differences between rotting in different scenarios.
But of course, these scenarios are taking place over years. Right, because I can only get a tiny amount of medlar. And so when they come to me, it's always really lucky. And one year I got them from a park in Seattle and they were a little mildewy and they had this effervescence and this kind of outdoor zing to them that was really delicious while not being delicious at all. In my recipe tests for this book, I was able to get some medlars from another friend in Seattle. But since then, I found some medlars in Spokane. And I've learned how to blet them in my basement. So it's a much more reliable crop, but doesn't taste quite, doesn't have the same kind of wild depth of flavor. But you know what I did figure out was like, if you kind of basically do a decoction of the medlar, you don't eat the actual fruit, but you boil some of the flavor out of it, the liquid that's created by that is delicious. You can turn that into a jelly that is quite delicious. But I do also wonder if it's just this kind of essence of something that's about to go bad. And essence of falling leaves is what it kind of tastes like. So it might not even taste like just the medlar. It might just taste like late fall.
I mean, sounds lovely, but also you did lose me at mildew. So
Right? No, I mean, this is, I guess it ties to our question of, you know, what is a rose? If a plum and a pear is a rose, the way that poem is that we're going to read is going to trouble these words and these definitions and categories. Something that I'm getting a big kick out of the deeper I get into food writing is kind of troubling categories of edibility. You know, we have built them up over time because of culture, because of safety, because of what can be transported to us and what can't. Some parts of inedibility will remain. That is, you know, don't eat poison, for example. But I make cheese now, and half the time what I make really looks like something that should be thrown in the garbage. You know, does like my eyes are saying, watch out, but my palate is saying, oh no, this is good. But for me to get over my kind of initial queasiness with basically these colonies of mold and bacterial cultures and yeast that I was making in my basement, it took a lot of encouragement, we'll say, from the woman that I'm learning how to make cheese from, Laura Lee Misterly. I had to have this person that was like, no, this is edible. I know it looks terrifying, but try it. It's interesting. See what you think.
So I know you mentioned in an email when I first contacted you that you knew a few poems by heart. Tell me a little bit about the poems that you know and your relationship to knowing things by heart. No need to recite anything. I'm just curious about what's in your personal
memory.
What's in your library?
It had never occurred to me to memorize a poem until I got to grad school. So I got my MFA in poetry at the University of Washington. And I was taking a class with Rick Kenny, who is a fabulous poet and teacher. And one of the exercises he asked us to do was to memorize poems. And quickly, what we realized not only was how fun it was, but how competitive it could be. And what a great, in some ways, what a great like party trick and what a great way to connect with people. Partially because it's pretty rare that people have poems memorized nowadays. So it's a moment that makes some people stop and be like, wait, what is that? Which to a certain number of us poets, we crave, you know.
Right.
But I think it also, so I was startled and excited by the new way I could enjoy and understand the music of a poem if I had it in just in my brain to recite. So I memorized Tell Me the Truth About Love by W.H. Auden because his work is so musical. It's easier to memorize, but it was also just a fun one to, you know, bring out at parties when everybody's getting a little bit drunk and will tolerate you and your poem, your kind of long love poem. And there's something old fashioned about it, I think, that was fun at the time. I also memorized in competition and collaboration with another poet friend of mine, This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin. And that's the poem that has stuck in my head and that I bring out at appropriate and inappropriate times. I mean, I was doing a talk at UW in one of my former teacher's classrooms, and it was an undergraduate class, and she had asked me a question about being a parent, and I couldn't figure out a good answer, so I just said the poem, This Be the Verse, which starts, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. They do not mean to, but they do. And it was just such a relief in that moment to be able to reach to what someone else has to say about being flawed and trying.
Absolutely. I love that poem too. I mean, I memorized it actually when my first son was really young, partly out of like a kind of contrarian spirit. You know, I know that I'm not good at, you know, I know that I'm not aiming for perfection as a parent, but more and more, it's just a comfort to me rather than a contrarian, I'm no mommy blogger sort of thing. Do you want to just say the poem we're talking about?
Oh, sure.
Recite it for us, please.
This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They do not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands down misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
Beautiful. Thank you.
So funny. So much about poetry
that I actually did not understand was funny until I started reading it out loud, which, you know, makes me sad for my previous self of just reading poems quietly in a coffee shop and feeling deep.
Right. Because there's so much about timing. There's so much timing. I mean, it's like stand-up comedy. Like, the best is super condensed and has perfect timing, something completely unexpected. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also just the voice that's speaking to us across the void of time and distance and mortality. And I don't know, to get to try to hear that, I suppose, with my own voice or by listening to someone else recite it, is this, I wish we could have it every day. Wish it was an everyday luxury.
Yeah, agreed. So since the poem that we are remembering today is actually very short, I was wondering if you can offer up a little bonus for us of something practical to memorize. Do you have any baking ratios or cooking ratios or anything you know by heart, which we can right here try to absorb before we do the poem?
Okay, pie crust, great pie crust. You ready? 2.5 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 cup of fat. That can be cold butter, cold lard, cold shortening, whatever you want.
It has to be a solid fat, though.
Solid fat for this recipe, solid fat. 1 tablespoon of sugar, 1 teaspoon of salt. Okay. Water. Those are the main ingredients.
Okay. 2.5 flour.
Mm-hmm.
1 fat.
Mm-hmm. 1 tablespoon sugar, 1 teaspoon salt, and then an amount of water that will make these ingredients just come together. It's usually a little bit less than 8 tablespoons, which is also 1/2 cup.
Okay, wonderful. It's so nice to just have a rule of thumb to not always have to, like in the kitchen, it feels so empowering to not have to look at a recipe when you start making something.
I think the thing to remember is 2.5 cups flour, 1 cup fat.
Okay.
The other stuff you can kind of mess around with, but those two need to be just right.
We can all do that. Thank you. Okay, well, Kate, would you mind going ahead and reading Robert Frost's The Rose Family for us?
He has some tricky line breaks in this that are fun. The Rose Family. The rose is a rose and was always a rose. But the theory now goes that the apple's a rose and the pear is, and so is the plum, I suppose. The deer only knows what will next prove a rose. You, of course, are a rose, but we're always a rose.
Thank you again to Kate Lebo for a wonderful reading and conversation. It is time to let her voice guide you through this poem of Robert Frost's The Rose Family. So the poem at hand starts off with a famous line of Gertrude Stein's, which feels equal parts homage and frisky sibling. Frost's poem matches her playfulness.
The rose is a rose and was always a rose. The rose is a rose and was always a rose.
At the same time, Frost is kind of rejecting her rejection of metaphor and flowery language. But he is bringing in a third thing, a botanical taxonomy stretches the platonic sense of a rose to its absolute limit.
But the theory now goes that the apple's a rose and the pear is, and so is the plum, I suppose. But the theory now goes that the apple's a rose and the pear is, and so is the plum, I suppose.
The other day I was doing a little research on native trees for a school garden landscaping project I'm working on. I landed on the Santa Cruz Island ironwood as a good evergreen, drought-hardy option. They grow up to 40 feet tall, have shaggy bark and foliage like dark, glossy marijuana leaves. Genus, Lionothamnus. Family, Rosacea. The rose family.
The deer only knows what will next prove a rose. You, of course, are a rose, but we're always a rose. The deer only knows what will next prove a rose. You, of course, are a rose, but we're always a rose.
Thank you again to Kate Lebo for being with us here today. And that was our poem. I hope it unfolded for you in a way which made you glad to make it your own. And I hope you can hold on to it. Review it on paper or let it live more like a song in your memory. Thank you to Susie Boyt for lending me this podcast's title. To G.W. Suck and the X for use of their song, The Art of Losing, which borrows the words of Elizabeth Bishop.